Hi, I'm Mark Polymeropoulos, host of the Above Average Intelligence podcast here on the DSR Network. Every Monday, I speak with journalists, authors, and of course, actual former intelligence officers, spies like myself, for a look at current events from the perspective of the intelligence community. If that sounds good to you, then please consider becoming a member of the DSR Network. Members of the DSR Network gain access to exclusive content, access to the DSR Slack and Discord communities, expanded show notes for select episodes, and more. All of this for just $7 a month or $70 for a year. As a thank you for listening, I'm offering 25% off the regular membership price. Please visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy and enter code Intel. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy and code Intel.
This is Above Average Intelligence, a production of the DSR Network. Each week, hosts Mark Polymeropoulos and David Rothkopf are joined by leading experts from the intelligence community for expert analysis on the biggest security challenges around the world.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm Mark Polymeropoulos, and this is DSR's Above Average Intelligence Show. Today, I am thrilled to welcome a very good friend of mine, Mr. Michael Weiss. How can I describe you? From Queens, New York to Dartmouth College, kind of like my journey from New Brunswick, New Jersey to Cornell. I don't know. And now, one of the, I will say it, and I'll embarrass you a little bit, one of the great investigative journalists of our time, author of a book on ISIS that was extremely well received, a bestseller, ISIS Inside the Army of Terror, previously at the Daily Beast. At Yahoo, your resume is very impressive, and now, of course, you're the editor of The Insider, which is a fantastic investigative journalism magazine focusing on Russia. And so, Michael, welcome to the show.
So is that Red Sox jersey meant to bait me? Is that your passive-aggressive?
I'm triggering you. So this is the worst-kept secret on the planet, if anyone follows me on Twitter or social media or anything, or my media hits, is that I'm a fanatic Red Sox fan, and I'm also in Boston right now. For opening day. So let's see, I did a hit this morning with Jonathan Lemire on Way Too Early wearing a Red Sox polo shirt, to the great chagrin of the executive producers, who told me this is a serious subject we're talking about on Gaza and other things. Do not talk about the Red Sox. So I wore the shirt, couldn't help myself. And I was even interviewed by NBC Boston 10 yesterday walking around Fenway. So I sent that out, and I'll be off to the game now. This is good.
I felt safer in war-torn Aleppo wearing whatever I wanted than I would feel in Boston wearing anything with a whiff of a Yankees insignia.
Yeah, you wouldn't want to do that. That would not be a very good idea. But you know, there's. I think what I try to do. You know me well. I don't take myself all that seriously. So the Red Sox stuff is fun. I know we're going to talk about some serious things today. But as you know from this podcast too, so I'll talk a little bit about Red Sox, about my love of heavy metal music. My taste has actually switched from a little Five Finger Death Punch now to Slipknot, where I've been obsessively listening to Slipknot. I've gotten my 21-year-old son into it, which is disturbing.
You're like season 3 AJ Soprano in your musical taste.
That's right. And I just, you know, I don't know. My wife thinks I'm nuts. I told her the other day, I said, you know, it's August 31st. And she said, what? I said, it's Rocklahoma.
What's that?
It's a giant 3-day heavy metal festival. And she said, are you really going to take your son to this? And I said, yes. Because I took him to see Metallica at Giant Stadium. That was a rite of passage.
Okay, that's cool. So my wife just took a new job at Universal Record Group, which is the company that owns, among other things, Taylor Swift and her label. So for my daughter's 9th birthday, we're going to see Taylor Swift in New Orleans.
That's huge.
Which is kind of cool because it's her first concert ever. And, you know, she's a 9-year-old girl. So
she'd be the hero of her school. This is ridiculous.
She's going to be the hero of her school. And I don't think there's backstage access with this, but if there is, then I'm going to be parent. Well, my wife is going to be mom.
Oh, that's right. I think you'll get parents of the year anyhow. So today, you know, there's a couple things to go over. What we do is in this show is talk a lot about current events at first. Obviously events going on, you know, kind of the war in Ukraine. And then we'll kind of get into the more deep dive substantive piece. But I think what we'll do, because what The Insider, along with 60 Minutes and Der Spiegel put out over the last, you know, week or so, was a really extraordinary investigation. And I would argue that it is current events. because it has to do with Russian intelligence malfeasance. So why don't you start off with, I have a million questions on this, your methodology, what this means, but why don't you start off with and tell the audience about the details of this really extraordinary investigation into Russian intelligence and in particular Russian military intelligence.
Sure. So I joined the Insider last summer, and the Insider is a publication run by Russian exiles, an independent news organization, not longer in Russia, but now based abroad, founded by Roman Dobrokhotov, and one of the lead investigative journalists there is Christo Grozev, star of Stage and Screen. Everyone knows this guy's name because he's famously unmasked the Navalny poisoners, the Skripal poisoners before that, and a succession of other Russian intelligence and military operations. And so Christo and Roman have been looking into what's known as Havana syndrome, or as the U.S. government calls it, anomalous health incidents, since about 2020. 60 Minutes has been looking into it for a little longer than that. They've done four or five segments on the program, mostly dealing with victims of Havana syndrome, who've told their stories, the circumstances under which they were stricken with some, hitherto unexplainable, mysterious set of injuries, there are core characteristics to them. That's why it is called a syndrome. Anyway, 60 was doing its fifth segment, and they approached the Insider and said, look, we know that the U.S. intelligence community has come out, the ODNI, last March and said, it is, quote, very unlikely that a foreign adversary is responsible for this. And this is, I mean, I think listeners of your show, Mark, know that you are one of the victims of Havana syndrome. And your story has been told in granular detail, including we published your memoir at the Insider in conjunction with our investigation. So it's, suddenly people feel an intense amount of pressure and pain in their head. There's a directionality to it, suggesting that they're caught up in some kind of energy beam. Chronic headaches, nausea, vertigo, sometimes more debilitating symptoms and conditions, including, as we're now finding out, something called Meniere's disease, which is holes in the inner ear. So the government's been looking into this for a long time. They concluded last year, very unlikely, although there were varying levels of confidence amongst all the U.S. intelligence agencies, very unlikely a foreign adversary is responsible. But prior to this, the scuttlebutt out of the IC was, we suspect that this is the act of a foreign adversary using directed energy weapons. So either acoustic sound or pulse microwave radiation. We know that this technology has been developed and researched, including by the Russians for quite a while, going back to the Soviet period. There was just some controversy or debate as to how far along they'd gotten in their R&D, right? And whether or not such a device could feasibly exist, much less be mobile and concealable. So we decided to start very basically, okay, let us assume for the sake of argument that the Russians are up to no good and they are doing this. Who in the Russian intelligence services would be capable? Who would have the means? Who has the remit in terms of what the organization is founded to do, not espionage, but kinetic operations? And we thought that if there is a likely culprit here, it would be GRU Unit 29155. So this is a military unit of Russia's military intelligence service. It was reconstituted in 2009. It previously had been a training unit, reconstituted to be a special task unit, which is to say they go around doing assassination and sabotage. In one case in Montenegro, they attempted a coup on the eve of that country's accession to NATO. And 29155 is sort of near and dear to us at the Insider because, I mentioned the Skripal assassination attempt. That was them. They're the ones that blew up a host of ammunition weapons depots across Bulgaria and the Czech Republic in the last decade. They did the Montenegro coup, as I mentioned. So this is basically the blunt instrument of Vladimir Putin's, malign activities abroad, outside of Russia. Although, funnily enough, I say that we have done an investigation recently that suggests 29155 is operating inside Russia too, targeting Russian dissidents and opposition figures. But that's another story. So anyway, we decided to look at the mountain of evidence and data that we have on this particular unit, and by that I mean email correspondence, courtesy of hacktivists who penetrated the, you know, the burner accounts, or in some cases the official government accounts of members of these of this unit. Travel data. So one of the ways that Christo and Ramon go about piecing together how we know these guys are responsible for some act of violence anywhere in the world is we look at what's happened in that part of the world, and we see that they've traveled there under fake identities. So passports issued, in quick succession, which doesn't happen in nature. So two or three operatives will literally have passports serialized 1, 2, 3, which is suggestive that they're, you know, Russian intelligence officers under diplomatic cover, or not diplomatic cover in this case, traveling as, you know, John Q. Citizen. And then we can also, in some cases, acquire more substantive data, receipts of car rentals, hotel bills. These guys are quite sloppy in their tradecraft, or they have been historically. So some of them take their cell phones with them. We can check cell phone metadata. All of this, by the way, available on the dark web for sale. Russia, paradoxically, is one of the most transparent countries in the world, because what happens is everything from your traffic records, your driver's license, your passport photos, your tax returns exist online, and corrupt Russian security officers moonlight working for consultancies, security consultancies. They steal the data from their government servers and put it up for sale for their private vendors, right? Corruption equals transparency in this case.
It's a beautiful thing.
So anyway, we get into the weeds of all of this, and we figure out where they've gone, when they've gone, and so on. And so in this investigation, we had a pretty good lead that a guy called Albert Avryanov was in Tbilisi, Georgia in October of 2021. And 60 Minutes had obtained the rights to interview a victim who was hit in Tbilisi in her laundry room, taking out a load from the dryer with an open window. The left side of her head suddenly starts feeling this intense pressure and pain, sort of an acute event. She likened it to a protagonist in a Hollywood thriller when there's a big explosion going off, you know, that kind of ringing sound that you hear, which is meant to be the inside of that person's head. That's what she experienced. And then she projectile vomited in the bathroom. Anyway, because she had gone through the overseas hazard training, she is the wife of a diplomat, a DOJ attaché who was stationed at the U.S. Embassy in Tbilisi. She clocked her surroundings to want to see if, you know, if this is foul play, I want to know who, what, where, when. So she went outside and she looked at a car parked right across from her house. It was a black Mercedes crossover. And she noticed right away, getting into the car was a very tall guy with blonde hair. Striking features. He looked right at her face as she was reaching into her pocket to take her cell phone, to take a photo of him. Gets in the car. She doesn't get a shot of the guy, but she gets a shot of the plates of the car as it's driving away. So we thought, Albert Avryanov, what's interesting about this guy is he is the son of the founding commander of Unit 29155, a guy called Andrei Avryanov. Andrei Avryanov, since 2009, has been responsible for all the aforementioned operations abroad, including, we suspect, things that we haven't yet depuzzled, right? Figured out what they've blown up, who they've killed, whatever. He's so successful in his career that he's now deputy director of the GRU. He has inherited, in its entirety, Russia's foreign policy and lucrative portfolio in Africa from the late, great Yevgeny Prigozhin, whose assassination, by the way, Avryanov is implicated in. We suspect that he might have been the guy who actually planted the bomb on Prigozhin's private jet. Another story. Anyway, his son also rises. He's been grooming his kid since he's 16 years old to take over the family business and to become the new commander of 29155. So it would make sense you send your kid, who's now in his 20s, out into the field to do something kinetic, to earn his stripes, right? Because nobody in the cadre of 29155 is going to trust this young kid to take over unless he's actually seen the action his father and they have. Anyway, we didn't expect to get a positive identification, but Joy, as we're calling her, it's a fake name, took one look at the photo of Albert and said, that looks exactly like the guy I saw. And she remembers looking right into his eyes. He looked right back at her. The facial features, the height, he's about 6'3" or so, much taller than the average Georgian in the neighborhood she was living in, and the blonde hair. Well, that was interesting. Then in the course of the sort of tail end of the investigation, we're talking a week or two before we're ready to publish, we remember that there, you know, this is called Havana syndrome. It's a misnomer. It's called Havana syndrome because the first cases that came to light in 2017 were recorded in Havana, Cuba, at the mission, the U.S. Embassy there, so State Department, CIA, a year earlier in 2016. There was a host of cases. We know personally one of them, Patient Zero, who goes by Adam in the press. However, there had been recorded cases earlier than 2016. And one of the ones that we had come into possession of was in 2014 in Frankfurt, Germany, at the U.S. consulate there. So we, through a proxy, were finding out the history of another case, 2014, stricken in November of that year, hit so badly by something that this person was knocked unconscious and woke up in a nearby hospital. Diagnosed, such same as you, same as Joy, with a mild traumatic brain injury and a host of other medical complications. So we knew the travel patterns, as I say, of 29155 throughout Europe, and we had seen an intense uptick in their travel to Central and Western Europe, including Germany. And as I said before, we even managed to get car rental receipts and hotel bills. You know, the thing about these guys, I say their tradecraft is sloppy, but at a very baseline, it's not. So they never go directly from Moscow to the place where they want to blow something up or kill somebody, right? They have a lot of decoy destinations. They take a sinuous route to get there. Whatever, we figure out where they're ultimately trying to go. And we clocked a guy, Yegor Gordienko, who was actually Albert Avrianov's mentor when his father was sort of sent him to Geneva and said, go study under this guy. He's one of my top men. That was Gordienko. He was in Frankfurt just weeks before this person who we're calling Taylor was hit. And what's interesting about this case is Taylor said in the weeks before that experience, Taylor was out in the parking lot of the U.S. consulate and saw a big, bulky, military-looking guy looking at diplomatic plates on cars, so reconnoitering or, you know, doing surveillance of some kind. Taylor goes up to the guy. What the hell are you doing here? And he mutters something in Russian and skulks off. Showed a photograph of Gordienko to Taylor. Taylor's positive identification of him was even more unambiguous and more categorical. I'm getting goosebumps just looking at this photo. That's him. I bet my life on it, kind of thing. So now what do we have? We have two cases of AHIs. Cases, by the way, that we were able to verify. These are not cranks. These are not psychosomatic cases. People are not making this up. We've looked at the medical records. We looked at, in the case of Joy and Tbilisi, talked to the doctor, the neurosurgeon. These are real. There is a physiological effect that has taken place. And both of them spotted members of 29155 in their immediate vicinity where they were stricken, either immediately after an attack or, you know, in the weeks leading up to it when they would be reconnoitering the targets, right? Kind of coincidental or not. Finally, what else do we have? Well, amongst the trove of email correspondence that was obtained through, you know, these hacktivists in, I think, 2019, we found that another guy, Terentiev, who is a scientific engineer for 29155, who also moonlights doing research for the Ministry of Defense on weapon systems and whatever. He was getting a job as Putin's personal envoy to a Far East region in Siberia. It's a pretty plum gig. The title is that of federal inspector, so technically above the governor of the region. So you can imagine the potential for making just loads of money on the side. I mean, this is rich in natural resources, oil, gas, minerals, whatever. And also, because the Kremlin still likes to pretend it's above board, they have an anti-corruption office in the presidential administration. Right. It wants to know, like, what have you done in your past? Have you paid your taxes? Where do you get your money? So he's going back and forth with basically, you know, the forensic accountant of this office, who says there's a disbursement in your checking account we can't account for. Where did this money come from? Finally, he goes, well, I won a competition hosted by the Ministry of Defense, one of their institutes. What's the competition? The competition was for research in non-lethal acoustic weapons. That's very interesting because in 2022, September of 2022, the intelligence community published, albeit in a classified fashion, an expert panel report on the plausible causes of Havana syndrome. Now, this report was eventually obtained by your lawyer and the lawyer of dozens of other Havana syndrome victims, Mark Zaid, through a Freedom of Information Act. It's redacted, but not redacted so much that you can't get the gist of it. It's publicly available online. You can link to it from the podcast. And one of the plausible explanations for Havana, in addition to pulse microwave radiation, is acoustic sound waves. So acoustic sound entering into the inner ear can actually cause physiological damage to the brain. It can compromise the blood-brain barrier, can do a host of other things that would be consistent with some of the symptoms we see with Havana syndrome. So here we have 29155, not just the Russians, not just Russian intelligence, but the specific military unit that goes around killing people and blowing stuff up, doing the kind of R&D that the USIC has said would be a likely or plausible explanation for what causes this thing. And we see two different operatives who have been identified, corroborated by eyewitnesses and victims in the exact time frame and in the vicinity of where they were attacked. So are we saying case closed? We've cracked the mystery and we can bring this to court? No. Are we saying this is a hell of a lot of evidence that was not in the public domain, and we hope was in the possession of the USIC when they conducted their investigation into Havana syndrome, which certainly points the finger eastward at Moscow. If there is any foreign adversary responsible for this, it's almost certainly the Russians, and it's almost certainly this unit of military intelligence.
So that was a fantastic overview, and I think there's a couple points just to add. One is, the 60 Minutes had an individual, the former head of the Defense Intelligence Agency's AHI team, Greg Edgreen, come on and said, frankly, the Russians did it. That to me was quite significant. But you know, talk a little bit about first the reaction to this piece, and then after that we'll jump into what I think we anticipate will be the intelligence community's reaction. But first, kind of what's the general overview reaction? Let me just throw one part in there. It seems to me, again, obviously living back in the Washington DC area, but certainly monitoring the foreign press, that this story and your investigation, really was seized upon by a lot of European governments as well, who I think tend to agree more with kind of your hypotheses on this rather than what the U.S. intelligence community is saying. But again, what was the reaction to the piece?
I mean, I would say the majority was positive. I think within that sort of category of positive reaction, the criticism would be, well, this is all very circumstantially compelling evidence, but again, you haven't solved the case. We don't pretend to. Right. I mean, at the end of the story, we say this may one day be proven, similar to Gulf War syndrome.
Or Agent Orange, burn pits.
Exactly. Yeah. But did you all know this? Because we didn't until we started the investigation. And I think that the victims have the right, and we have a responsibility to show them that, very unlikely, at least by my lights. And again, I'm not in the intelligence community. I don't come up with I don't determine these assessments, but very really, because, it's seeming a little likelier now. They have the means, they have the motive, and they have the knowledge of exactly the kind of technology that would be used here. There's a lot of people in the scientific community who don't believe, for instance, that pulse microwave, weaponry could be miniaturized to a level where it's concealable, right? One of the things that we uncovered in the course of our investigation, the Soviets were futzing around with the same kind of thing. This was in like the 1986 collapse of the Soviet Union, 91. All of this stuff was, this research was being conducted in Kharkiv in Ukraine, right? So it gets spirited away back to Moscow by the KGB. And their conclusion was, we can cause grievous physiological effects to the human body. They were experimenting on, as you can imagine, rats and monkeys, probably also people because it was the Soviet Union. The problem is the tech is so large. We're looking at like a satellite dish that would have to be mounted on the chassis of a commercial vehicle. So it's not the kind of thing you can kind of hide around in suburban America, or, like this Tony suburb of Tbilisi without getting noticed. However, and again, this is like the late 80s, early 90s, we anticipate in future that we'll be able to miniaturize this and make it mobile and concealed. Now, I can tell you without getting into specifics, a lot of people who used to be in the IC like to talk, and sometimes they say things that they probably shouldn't. And I can tell you that people who investigated this told us when they went into the sort of classified intelligence aspects of it all, they had found that the Russians had advanced much further in this field of non-lethal directed energy than they had ever anticipated, without going into specifics. But there was a kind of soft confirmation that we were on the right track. Now, there are those who believe that we are completely off base, and that this is all just a, you know, fool's errand, because Havana syndrome doesn't exist, right? There have been innumerable studies, including by the NIH and independent scholars and sociologists and psychologists, who believe that this is a sociogenic or a psychogenic illness, which is to say mass hysteria. You know, I sit here and I tell you, hey, you know, something weird happened to me yesterday. I feel pressure in the head. There's a ringing in my ears. I'm nauseous. I have headache. And then tomorrow you wake up and you think the same thing's happening to me, right? And that this spread like wildfire. The problem with that is also a problem. My criticism of that argument, apart from the fact that we've, as I said, examined medical records, is that a lot of the things that skeptics use to try and debunk the existence of Havana syndrome can actually be used to debunk the idea that Havana syndrome is not real. In other words, it is technically not true that this only afflicts American officials, CIA, State Department, DOD. There's a load of Canadians who are suffering, diplomats and spies. So leave that to one side. But the question is, why no Brits? Why no French? Why no Germans? To the best of our knowledge, anyway. Maybe there are cases that haven't come forward. The British, the French, the Germans can read about Havana syndrome in the English language press or in translation because it's been covered internationally. How come they don't have this psyche? Right? So, you know, again, is there precedence in the annals of Soviet and Russian intelligence tradecraft to only target Americans using a specific kind of modality? Yes, the KGB basically did have its own kind of line of approach toward what they call the main adversary. So, you know, could they be dealing with the Brits and the French and the Germans in other ways? Because that's a more permissive environment, Europe, than North America has been. Sure. I mean, there's a lot of different ways we can speculate about this. But, you know, suffice it to say, at least in the cases we've examined, now, obviously, you're going to get a lot of false positives, a lot of emails of cranks who think, you know, they're wearing tinfoil around their head. They think they have Havana. They don't. But when you look at the medical records, you look at the case histories. I mean, you yourself, Mark, I've known you for, what, 5-6 years. You're a highly decorated CIA officer. I know the kinds of countries you were parachuted into without knowing the specifics of the work you did. These are very stressful, high-intensity environments. You came away, you might have had PTSD, but you didn't have these symptoms. You were not required to be medically retired. Then you go on an official trip in the capacity of as CIA officer, as director of European and Eurasian operations to Moscow. They know you're there as an officer of the CIA because you're there to lead with your counterparts about counterterrorism. And in your hotel room, this happens to you? It doesn't make sense. And again, this is one of a dozen cases we've examined in minute detail where it just doesn't add up. We know the people involved. We've talked to their family, their friends. We know their backgrounds, their pre-existing or underlying medical conditions. In some cases, there are none. And suddenly, it's this acute event. And it happens usually in a place. I mean, this is another part of the puzzle, right? We devote a lot of space to looking at what the known cases, the subset we're examining, what did they do for a living? Or what did they kind of muck about with? Well, if they're in the CIA, chances are, overwhelmingly, they're Russia hands, or they were stationed to some post-Soviet or Warsaw Pact country.
Right. And I think that's quite significant, too. I always saw those patterns that a lot of my former colleagues, as well as myself, who were affected by this, had some element in their career, something significant in kind of pushback against the Russians. A couple points to add, and then I just want to go back to that last question about reaction. But I will say that you know, the Hill, the congressional intelligence committees, both in the House and the Senate, seem surprised by your investigation, meaning they hadn't heard this before, and frankly, the White House as well. And I can't really give more details of that. But ultimately, you have your investigation kind of raising more questions. And so what I think a lot of us also, just based on past practices, expect is the intelligence community, you know, they're almost a cat stuck in a tree now. I don't think we should expect them to say, thank you very much, Michael and Christo and Roman, you know, you did us a great service. I would expect some pushback on this. And I guess the question, so let's just say that happens. But the question for you is, what is it? Why is the intelligence community so, and the analytic side of the house, not the operational side of the house, who I think I know believes this, but the analytic side of the house, why are they so dead set on pointing their finger at Russia as an adversary? It's a question that no one seems to be able to answer sufficiently. What are your thoughts?
I want to answer that question, but before, I want to answer a question that occurred to me while you were explaining how they're caught up in the tree. Look, the IC can do one of two things. They can say, we had all of this data, all of this evidence, we have it, we've examined it. We still came out and concluded it's very unlikely the Russians are behind it. My question to that is how and why? Because if you're just a layman reading this, it certainly seems like maybe the Russians might have a hand in this.
Yeah, thumbs up.
Right. And then I would ask, what is the methodology of your investigation? Did you interview victims? Did you show them a virtual lineup of 29155 operatives? Did they identify any of them? How many Russia hands did you have looking into this? Did you even know about 29155, what their raison d'etre is? They don't do espionage, right? Half the puzzle for us was, if these guys are in town, they're there to do something bad, meaning physical, right? So, and if they're there in the presence of these victims, there's a high likelihood that they're responsible for the ordeal that these victims, suffered. So that's that. As to your question, why might they be trying to downplay this or sweep this under the rug? There were two prevailing hypotheses amongst, victims and people who think that there is some there and that there is a bit of a, if not, let's use the word cover up, then an intense debate where the wrong side has won out in terms of the institutional line. The first is, well, if you say that the Russians are doing this, is it an act of war? And if you conclude that it is, well, what do you do about it? There's a fear of escalation. There's a fear of escalation when we're not even in the fight, like in Ukraine. If we give weapon X to the Ukrainians, what if they use it and they hit the Russians inside Russia? And, oh my God, it's the end of the world. It's World War III. And, these are not unfounded fears. I don't mean to make too light of them. The Russians threaten to nuke the West on an hourly basis to reduce the fall to radioactive ash, right? The fear of escalation is real. And so it might be the case that people decided, well, okay, we have, let's not say hundreds or thousands of cases, but really credibly, let's say a dozen, maybe two or three dozen cases at most. People aren't getting killed. Some of them carry on in their jobs. We know people who are victims who are still in the CIA or still in the State Department. Others, such as yourself, are medically retired. We'll pay them some money. We'll take care of them. We'll pay their medical bills. But we can't really, chalk this up to anything other than the kind of Cold War games we're very used to playing with the Russians, right? They use microwave radiation to try and spy on the U.S. embassy, and they cause cancer in American diplomats to the point where Henry Kissinger told the Soviets to knock it off, right? So we're used to this. That's the first explanation. The second is, if you say this is real and it's a foreign adversary that's doing it, that you're acknowledging that you cannot protect your people in the field. So who's going to want to volunteer or be recruited to CIA or State Department or DOD and go abroad with their family? This is an important piece of it. There's so many different moving parts here. I lose track of some of them, but it's not just American officials. It's their family members who have been stricken with this. And by family members, I mean wives or husbands, small children. In some cases, pets, dogs have under, so again, it's psychosomatic. The dogs are reading the National.
How do you have a psychosomatic 6 month old?
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So, but you made it. That's a really good point because while we sign up for the agency and understand the hazards of service, usually it has to do with someone trying to blow up an embassy or a terrorist cell coming after an officer, a U.S. government facility. This one is so much more nebulous. And I think it did strike fear into the minds of many CIA officers. I know one friend of mine who actually resigned because of this. He did not want to go back out anymore. And I think that, as we conclude this part of the discussion, I think ultimately that's not an excuse for the IC. The fear of escalation or the concern of staffing, U.S. facilities abroad, that should not override the health and welfare of one's officers, and so I think your reporting certainly generated a lot of questions, and I would think that in the days and weeks ahead, as the Congress, the congressional intelligence communities kind of get wind of this, dissect it, probably talk to a lot more individuals, call down members of the IC. This is certainly not the last time we're going to hear of this story.
Well, I have no problem telling you, Christo and I have both been contacted by a congressional committee to give evidence, right? And explain.
Well, I think you should.
Which we will. I mean, again, it's not just, you know, the duty of care for American Foreign Service people is one thing, right? And that speaks for itself. But there's a public interest, sure. You know, because what if the Russians are aiming at one person, but they miss and they hit bystanders? I mean, again, they hit family members, so they are doing that. But what if they hit people who have absolutely nothing to do with the target? We should know if this kind of technology exists, and we should know if our main adversary, frankly, has no compunction about using it against anybody.
Well, I think that was a fantastic piece. It's hard to argue with kind of the team you all put together. You know, powerful investigative reporters across the globe. You know, multiple countries, multiple continents. So we'll certainly hear about that in the future.
I just want to tell you, we're not done. Right. I mean, we have more. You know,
good. So bring it on.
This wasn't by any means exhaustive.
I think that probably is striking the fear in some in the IC who were so set in their ways on denying that this exists. This is the point in the podcast where we have to say goodbye to our guests who are not yet subscribers. If you want to listen to the rest of the podcast and all of the other shows in full, just go to the dsrnetwork.com and click on membership. It's only $7 a month, and it brings you a lot of great content. So if you're not a subscriber, we hope you will be soon. And if you are one, stand by. We'll be right back.
Thank you for listening to Above Average Intelligence, hosted every week by Mark Polymeropoulos and David Rothkopf. Above Average Intelligence is a production of the DSR Network and was produced by Riley Fessler.